Chapter 8. Moving quietly, he took the rope from its hiding place. One end of it was already prepared for making fast inside the window. Now it took him no time at all to reach the ground and to return. Now, with more than a year of practice, he could mount the rope hand over hand without once touching the wall of the house, with the shadow-like agility of a cat. Leaning from the window, he let the free end whisper down. In the moonlight, it looked not less frail than a spider skein. Then, with his shoes tied together and strung through his belt behind him, he slid down the rope, passing swift as a shadow across the window where the old people slept. The rope hung directly before the window. He drew it tautly aside, flat against the house, and tied it. Then he went on through the moonlight to the stable and mounted to the loft and took the new suit from its hiding place. It was wrapped in paper, carefully. Before unwrapping it, he felt with his hands about the folds of the paper. "He found it," he thought. "He knows," he said aloud, whispering. "The bastard. The son of a bitch." He dressed in the dark swiftly. He was already late, because he'd had to give them time to get to sleep after all the uproar about the heifer, the uproar which the woman had caused by meddling after it was all over. Settled for the night, anyway. The bundle included a white shirt and a tie. He put the tie into his pocket, but he put on the coat so that the white shirt wouldn't be so visible in the moonlight. He descended and emerged from the stable. The new cloth, after his soft, often washed overalls, felt rich and harsh. The house squatted in the moonlight, dark, profound, a little treacherous. It was as though in the moonlight the house had acquired personality, threatful, deceptive. He passed it and entered the lane. He took from his pocket a dollar watch. He'd bought it 3 days ago with some of the money. But he'd never owned a watch before, so he'd forgot to wind it. But he didn't need the watch to tell him that he was already late. The lane went straight beneath the moon, bordered on each side by trees whose shadowed branches lay thick and sharp as black paint upon the mild dust. He walked fast, the house now behind him, himself now not visible from the house. The high road passed the lane a short distance ahead. He expected at any moment to see the car rush past, since he'd told her that if he weren't waiting at the mouth of the lane, he would meet her at the schoolhouse where the dance was being held. But no car passed, and when he reached the high road, he could hear nothing. The road, the night, were empty. "Maybe she's already passed," he thought. He took out the dead watch again and looked at it. The watch was dead because he'd had no chance to wind it. He'd been made late by them who'd given him no opportunity to wind the watch, so know if he were late or not. Up the dark lane in the now invisible house, the woman now lay asleep, since she'd done all she could to make him late. He looked that way, up the lane. He stopped in the act of looking and thinking. Mind and body as if on the same switch, believing that he'd seen movement among the shadows in the lane. Then he thought that he hadn't, that it might perhaps have been something in his mind projected like a shadow on a wall. "But I hope it's him," he thought. "I wish it was him. I wish he'd follow me and see me get into the car. I wish he'd try to follow us. I wish he'd try to stop me." But he could see nothing in the lane. It was empty, intermittent with treacherous shadows. Then he heard from far down the road toward town the sound of the car. Looking, he saw presently the glare of the lights. She was a waitress in a small, dingy back street restaurant in town. Even a casual adult glance could tell that she'd never see 30 again. But to Joe, she probably didn't look more than 17, too, because of her smallness. She was not only not tall, she was slight, almost childlike. But the adult look saw that the smallness wasn't due to any natural slenderness, but to some inner corruption of the spirit itself, a slenderness which had never been young, and not one of whose curves anything youthful had ever lived or lingered. Her hair was dark. Her face was prominently boned, always down-looking, as if her head were set so on her neck, a little out of line. Her eyes were like the button eyes of a toy animal, a quality beyond even hardness, without being hard. It was because of her smallness that he ever attempted her, as if her smallness should have or might have protected her from the roving and predatory eyes of most men, leaving his chances better. If she'd been a big woman, he wouldn't have dared. He would have thought, won't be any use. She'll already have a fellow, a man. It began in the fall when he was 17. It was a day in the middle of the week. Usually when they came to town it would be Saturday and they would bring food with them. Cold dinner in a basket purchased and kept for that purpose, with the intention of spending the day. This time McEachern came to see a lawyer, with the intention of finishing his business and being home again by dinner time. But it was almost 12 o'clock when he emerged onto the street where Joe waited for him. He came into sight looking at his watch. Then he looked at a municipal clock in the courthouse tower, and then at the sun, with an expression of exasperation and outrage. He looked at Joe also with that expression, the open watch in his hand, his eyes cold, fretted. He seemed to be examining and weighing for the first time the boy whom he'd raised from childhood. Then he turned. "Come," he said. "Can't be helped now." The town was a railroad division point. Even in midweek there were many men about the streets. The whole air of the place was masculine, transient, a population even whose husbands were at home only at intervals and on holiday, a population of men who led esoteric lives, whose actual scenes were removed, and whose intermittent presence was pandered to, like that of patrons in a theater. Joe had never before seen the place to which McEachern took him. It was a restaurant on a back street, a narrow, dingy doorway between two dingy windows. He didn't know that it was a restaurant at first. There was no sign outside, and he could neither smell nor hear food cooking. What he saw was a long wooden counter lined with backless stools, and a big blonde woman behind a cigar case near the front, and a clump of men at the far end of the counter, not eating, who all turned as one and looked at him and McEachern when they entered, through the smoke of cigarettes. Nobody said anything at all. They just looked at McEachern and Joe as if breathing had stopped with talking, as if even the cigarette smoke had stopped and now drifted aimlessly of its own weight. The men weren't in overalls, and they all wore hats, and their faces were all alike, not young and not old. Not farmers and not townsmen either. They looked like people who just got off a train, and who would be gone tomorrow, and who didn't have any address. Sitting on two of the backless stools at the counter, McEachern and Joe ate. Joe ate fast because McEachern was eating fast. Beside him, the man, even in the act of eating, seemed to sit in a kind of stiff-backed outrage. The food which McEachern ordered was simple, quickly prepared and quickly eaten. But Joe knew that parsimony had no part in this. Parsimony might have brought them here in preference to another place, but he knew that it was a desire to depart quickly that had chosen the food. As soon as he laid down his knife and fork, McEachern said, "Come," already getting down from his stool. At the cigar counter, McEachern paid the brass-haired woman. There was about her a quality impervious to time, a belligerent and diamond-surfaced respectability. She hadn't so much as looked at them, even when they entered, and even when McEachern gave her money. Still, without looking at them, she made the change correctly and swiftly, sliding the coins onto the glass counter almost before McEachern had offered the bill, herself somehow definite behind the false glitter of the careful hair, the careful face, like a carved lioness guarding a portal, presenting respectability like a shield behind which the clotted and idle and equivocal men could slant their hats and their thwart face-curled cigarettes. McEachern counted his change, and they went out into the street. He was looking at Joe again. He said, "I'll have you remember that place. There are places in this world where a man may go, but a boy, a youth of your age, may not. That is one of them. Maybe you should never have gone there. But you must see such, so you will know what to avoid and shun. Perhaps it was as well that you saw it with me present, to explain and warn you. And the dinner there's cheap." "What's the matter with it?" Joe said. "That is the business of the town and not of yours. You will only mark my words. I will not have you go there again unless I am with you, which will not be again. We'll bring dinner next time, early or no early." That was what he saw that day while he was eating swiftly beside the unbending and quietly outraged man, the two of them completely isolated at the center of the long counter, with at one end of it the brass-haired woman, and at the other the group of men, and the waitress with her demure and down-looking face and her big, too big hands, setting the plates and cups, her head rising from beyond the counter at about the height of a tall child. Then he and McEachern departed. He didn't expect ever to return. It wasn't that McEachern had forbidden him. He just didn't believe that his life would ever again chance there. It was as if he said to himself, "They're not my people. I can see them, but I don't know what they're doing nor why. I can hear them, but I don't know what they're saying nor why nor to whom. I know that there's something about it beside food, eating, but I don't know what, and I never will know." So it passed from the surface of thinking. Now and then, during the next 6 months, he returned to town, but he didn't again even see or pass the restaurant. He could have, but he didn't think to. Perhaps he didn't need to. More often than he knew, perhaps thinking would have suddenly flowed into a picture, shaping, shaped. The long, barren, somehow equivocal counter with the still, cold-faced, violent-haired woman at one end as though guarding it, and at the other men with inward-leaning heads smoking steadily, lighting and throwing away their constant cigarettes, and the waitress, the woman not much larger than a child, going back and forth to the kitchen with her arms overladen with dishes, having to pass on each journey within touching distance of the men, who leaned with their slanted hats and spoke to her through the cigarette smoke, murmured to her somewhere near mirth or exultation, and her face musing, demure, downcast, as if she hadn't heard. "I don't even know what they're saying to her," he thought, thinking, "I don't even know what they are saying to her," is something that men don't say to a passing child. Believing, I don't know yet that in the instant of sleep, the eyelid closing prisons within the eye's self, her face demure, pensive, tragic, sad, and young, waiting, colored with all the vague and formless magic of young desire, that already there is something for love to feed upon, that sleeping I know now why I struck refraining that Negro girl 3 years ago, and that she must know it too, and be proud, too, with waiting and pride. So he didn't expect to see her again, since love in the young requires as little of hope as of desire to feed upon. Very likely he was as much surprised by his action and what it inferred and revealed as McEachern would have been. It was on Saturday this time, in the spring now. He'd turned 18. Again, McEachern had to see the lawyer, but he was prepared now. "I'll be there an hour," he said. "You can walk about and see the town." Again he looked at Joe, hard, calculating, again a little fretted, like a just man forced to compromise between justice and judgment. "Here," he said. He opened his purse and took a coin from it. It was a dime. "You might try not to throw it away as soon as you can find someone who'll take it." "It's a strange thing," he said fretfully, looking at Joe. "But it seems impossible for a man to learn the value of money without first having to learn to waste it. You'll be here in 1 hour." He took that coin and went straight to the restaurant. He didn't even put the coin into his pocket. He did it without plan or design, almost without volition, as if his feet ordered his action and not his head. He carried the dime, clutched, hot and small, in his palm as a child might. He entered the screen door, clumsily, stumbling a little. The blonde woman behind the cigar case, it was as if she hadn't moved in the 6 months, not altered one strand of her hard, bright, brass-ridged hair or even her dress, watched him. At the far end of the counter, the group of men with their tilted hats and their cigarettes and their odor of barbershops watched him. The proprietor was among them. He noticed, saw the proprietor for the first time. Like the other men, the proprietor wore a hat and was smoking. He wasn't a big man, not much bigger than Joe himself, with a cigarette burning in one corner of his mouth as though to be out of the way of talking. From that face, squinted and still behind the curling smoke from the cigarette, which wasn't touched once with hand until it burned down and was spat out and ground beneath the heel, Joe was to acquire one of his own mannerisms. But not yet. That was to come later, when life had begun to go so fast that accepting would take the place of knowing and believing. Now he just looked at the man who leaned upon the counter from the inward side, in a dirty apron which he wore as a footpad might assume for the moment a false beard. The accepting was to come later, along with the whole sum of entire outrage to credulity. These two people as husband and wife, the establishment as a business for eating, with the successive imported waitresses clumsy with the cheap dishes of simple food as business justified, and himself accepting, taking, during his brief and violent holiday, like a young stallion in a state of unbelieving and ecstatic astonishment, in a hidden pasture of tired and professional mares, himself in turn victim of nameless and unnumbered men. But that wasn't yet. He went to the counter, clutching the dime. He believed that the men had all stopped talking to watch him, because he could hear nothing now save a vicious frying sound from beyond the kitchen door, thinking, "She's back there. That's why I don't see her." He slid onto a stool. He believed that they were all watching him. He believed that the blonde woman behind the cigar case was looking at him, and the proprietor, too, across whose face now the smoke of the cigarette would have become quite still in its lazy vaporing. Then the proprietor spoke a single word. Joe knew that he hadn't moved nor touched the cigarette. "Bobby," he said. A man's name. It wasn't thinking. It was too fast, too complete. "She's gone. I got a man in her place. I've wasted the dime, like he said." He believed that he couldn't leave now, that if he tried to go out, the blonde woman would stop him. He believed that the men at the back knew this and were laughing at him. So he sat quite still on the stool, looking down the dime clutched in his palm. He didn't see the waitress until the two overlarge hands appeared upon the counter opposite him and into sight. He could see the figured pattern of a dress and the bib of an apron and the two big-knuckled hands lying on the edge of the counter, as completely immobile as if they were something she'd fetched in from the kitchen. "Coffee and pie," he said. Her voice sounded downcast, quite empty. "Lemon, coconut, chocolate." In proportion to the height from which her voice came, the hands couldn't be her hands at all. "Yes," Joe said. The hands didn't move. The voice didn't move. "Lemon, coconut, chocolate. Which kind?" To the others, they must have looked quite strange, facing one another across the dark, stained, grease-crusted, and friction-smooth counter. They must have looked a little like they were praying. The youth, country-faced, in clean and Spartan clothing, with an awkwardness which invested him with a quality unworldly and innocent, and the woman opposite him, downcast, still, waiting, who, because of her smallness, partook likewise of that quality of his, of something beyond flesh. Her face was high-boned, gaunt. The flesh was taut across her cheekbones, circled darkly about the eyes. Beneath the lowered lids, her eyes seemed to be without depth, as if they couldn't even reflect. Her lower jaw seemed too narrow to contain two rows of teeth. "Coconut," Joe said. His mouth said it because immediately he wanted to unsay it. He had only the dime. He'd been holding it too hard to have realized yet that it was only a dime. His hand sweated about it, upon it. He believed that the men were watching him and laughing again. He couldn't hear them, and he didn't look at them. But he believed that they were. The hands had gone away. Then they returned, setting a plate and a cup before him. He looked at her now, at her face. "How much is pie?" he said. "Pie is 10 cents. She was just standing there before him, beyond the counter, with her big hands again lying on the dark wood, with that quality spent and waiting. She'd never looked at him. He said in a faint, desperate voice, "I reckon I don't want no coffee." For a while she didn't move. Then one of the big hands moved and took up the coffee cup. Hand and cup vanished. He sat still, down looking too, waiting. Then it came. It wasn't the proprietor, it was the woman behind the cigar case. "What's that?" she said. "He don't want the coffee," the waitress said. Her voice, speaking, moved on as if she hadn't paused at the question. Her voice was flat, quiet. The other woman's voice was quiet, too. "Didn't he order a coffee, too?" she said. "No," the waitress said in that level voice that was still in motion, going away. "I misunderstood." When he got out, when his spirit, wrung with abasement and regret and passionate for hiding, scuttled past the cold face of the woman behind the cigar case, he believed that he knew he would and could never see her again. He didn't believe that he could bear to see her again. Even look at the street, the dingy doorway, even from a distance again. Not thinking yet. It's terrible to be young. It's terrible. Terrible. When Saturdays came, he found, invented, reasons to decline to go to town, with McEachern watching him, though not with actual suspicion yet. He passed the days by working hard, too hard. McEachern contemplated the work with suspicion, but there was nothing which the man could know, deduce. Working was permitted him. Then he could get the nights passed, since he would be too tired to lie awake, and in time even the despair and the regret and the shame grew less. He didn't cease to remember it, to react to it, but now it had become worn out, like a gramophone record, familiar only because of the worn threading which blurred the voices. After a while, even McEachern accepted a fact. He said, "I have been watching you lately, and now there is nothing for it but I must misdoubt my own eyes, or believe that at last you are beginning to accept what the Lord has seen fit to allot you. But I will not have you grow vain because I have spoken well of it. You'll have time and opportunity, and inclination too, I don't doubt, to make me regret that I have spoken, to fall into sloth and idleness again. However, reward was created for man the same as chastisement. Do you see that heifer yonder? From today, that calf is your own. See that I do not later regret it." Joe thanked him. Then he could look at the calf and say aloud, "That belongs to me." Then he looked at it, and was again too fast and too complete to be thinking, "That's not a gift. It's not even a promise. It's a threat." Thinking, "I didn't ask for it. He gave it to me. I didn't ask for it." Believing, "God knows I've earned it." It was a month later. It was Saturday morning. "I thought you did not like town any more," McEachern said. "I reckon one more trip won't hurt me," Joe said. He had a half dollar in his pocket. Mrs. McEachern had given it to him. He'd asked for a nickel. She insisted that he take the half dollar. He took it, holding it on his palm, cold contemptuously. "I suppose not," McEachern said. "You have worked hard, too. But town is no good habit for a man who has yet to make his way." He didn't need to escape, though he would have, even by violence, perhaps. But McEachern made it easy. He went to the restaurant fast. He entered without stumbling now. The waitress wasn't there. Perhaps he saw, noticed that she wasn't. He stopped at the cigar counter, behind which the woman sat, laying the half dollar on the counter. "I owe a nickel for a cup of coffee. I said pie and coffee before I knew that pie was a dime. I owe you a nickel." He didn't look toward the rear. The men were there in their slanted hats and with their cigarettes. The proprietor was there, waiting. Joe heard him at last in the dirty apron speaking past the cigarette. "What is it? What's he want?" "He says he owes Bobby a nickel," the woman said. "He wants to give Bobby a nickel." Her voice was quiet. The proprietor's voice was quiet. "Well, for Christ's sake," he said. To Joe, the room was full of listening. He heard, not hearing. He saw, not looking. He was now moving toward the door. The half dollar lay on the glass counter. Even from the rear of the room, the proprietor could see it, since he said, "What's that for?" "He says he owes for a cup of coffee," the woman said. Joe had almost reached the door. "Here, Jack," the man said. Joe didn't stop. "Give him his money," the man said, flat voice, not yet moving. The cigarette smoke would curl still across his face, unwinded by any movement. "Give it back to him," the man said. "I don't know what his racket is, but he can't work it here. Give it back to him." "You better go back to the farm, Hiram. Maybe you can make a girl there with a nickel." Now he was in the street, sweating the half dollar, the coin sweating his hand, larger than a cartwheel, feeling. He walked in laughter. He'd passed through the door upon it, upon the laughing of the men. It swept and carried him along the street, then it began to flow past him, dying away, letting him to earth, pavement. He and the waitress were facing one another. She didn't see him at once, walking swiftly, down-looking, in a dark dress and a hat. Again, stopped, she didn't even look at him, having already looked at him, all-seeing, like when she'd set the coffee and the pie on the counter. She said, "Oh, and you come back to give it to me. Before them. And they kidded you. Well, say, I thought you might have had to pay for it yourself. I thought, well, say, can you tie that? Can you now?" They weren't looking at one another, standing face to face. To another, they must have looked like two monks met during the hour of contemplation in a garden path. "I just thought that I..." "Where do you live?" she said. "In the country." "Well, say, what's your name?" "It's not McEachern," he said. "It's Christmas." "Christmas? That's your name? Christmas? Well, say..." On the Saturday afternoons, during and after adolescence, he and the other four or five boys hunted and fished. He saw girls only at church on Sunday. They were associated with Sunday and with church, so he couldn't notice them. To do so would be, even to him, a retraction of his religious hatred. But he and the other boys talked about girls. Perhaps some of them, the one who arranged with the Negro girl that afternoon, for instance, knew. "They all want to," he told the others, "but sometimes they can't." The others didn't know that. They didn't know that all girls wanted to, let alone that there were times when they couldn't. They thought differently, but to admit that they didn't know the latter would be to admit that they hadn't discovered the former. So they listened while the boy told them. "It's something that happens to him once a month." He described his idea of the physical ceremony. Perhaps he knew. Anyway, he was graphic enough, convincing enough. If he had tried to describe it as a mental state, something which he only believed, they wouldn't have listened. But he drew a picture, physical, actual, to be discerned by the sense of smell and even of sight. It moved them. The temporary and abject helplessness of that which tantalized and frustrated desire, the smooth and superior shape in which volition dwelled, doomed to be at stated and inescapable intervals, victims of periodical filth. That was how the boy told it, with the other five listening quietly, looking at one another, questioning in secret. On the next Saturday, Joe didn't go hunting with them. McEachern thought that he'd already gone, since the gun was missing. But Joe was hidden in the barn. He stayed there all that day. On the Saturday following, he did go, but alone, early, before the boys called for him. But he didn't hunt. He wasn't 3 miles from home when, in the late afternoon, he shot a sheep. He found the flock in a hidden valley and stalked and killed one with the gun. Then he knelt, his hands in the yet warm blood of the dying beast, trembling, dry-mouthed, back-glaring. Then he got over it, recovered. He didn't forget what the boy had told him, he just accepted it. He found that he could live with it, side by side with it. It was as if he said, illogical and desperately calm, "All right, it is so. Then, but not to me, Not in my life and my love. Then it was 3 or 4 years ago, and he'd forgotten it, in the sense that a fact is forgotten when it once succumbs to the mind's insistence that it be neither true nor false. He met the waitress on the Monday night following the Saturday on which he'd tried to pay for the cup of coffee. He didn't have the rope then. He climbed from his window and dropped the 10 feet to the earth and walked the 5 miles into town. He didn't think at all about how he would get back into his room. He reached town and went to the corner where she'd told him to wait. It was a quiet corner, and he was quite early, thinking, I will have to remember to let her show me what to do and how to do it and when, to not let her find out that I don't know, that I'll have to find out from her. He'd been waiting for over an hour when she appeared. He'd been that early. She came up on foot. She came and stood before him, small, with that air steadfast, waiting, down-looking, coming up out of the darkness. Here you are, she said. I got here as soon as I could. I had to wait for them to go to sleep. I was afraid I'd be late. Have you been here long? How long? I don't know. I ran most of the way. I was afraid I'd be late. You ran? All them 3 miles? It's 5 miles. It's not three. Well, say. Then they didn't talk. They stood there, two shadows facing one another. More than a year later, remembering that night, he said, suddenly knowing, it was like she was waiting for me to hit her. Well, she said. He'd begun now to tremble a little. He could smell her. Smell the waiting, still, wise, a little weary. Thinking, she's waiting for me to start, and I don't know how. Even to himself, his voice sounded idiotic. I reckon it's late. Late? Well, I thought maybe they'd be waiting for you. Waiting up until you... Waiting for... Her voice died, ceased. She said, not moving... They stood like two shadows. I live with Mame and Max, you know. The restaurant. You ought to remember them trying to pay that nickel. She began to laugh. There was no mirth in it, nothing in it. When I think of that, when I think of you coming in there with that nickel. Then she stopped laughing. There was no cessation of mirth in that either. The still, abject, down-looking voice reached him. I made a mistake tonight. I forgot something. Perhaps she was waiting for him to ask her what it was. But he didn't. He just stood there with the still, down-speaking voice dying somewhere about his ears. He'd forgot about the shot sheep. He'd lived with the fact which the older boy had told him too long now. With the slain sheep, he'd bought immunity from it for too long now for it to be alive. So he couldn't understand at first what she was trying to tell him. They stood at the corner. It was at the edge of town where the street became a road that ran on beyond the ordered and measured lawns, between small, random houses and barren fields. The small, cheap houses which compose the purlieus of such towns. She said, Listen, I'm sick tonight. He didn't understand. He said nothing. Perhaps he didn't need to understand. Perhaps he'd already expected some fateful mischance, thinking it was too good to be true anyway. thinking too fast for even thought. In a moment she'll vanish. She will not be. Then I'll be back at home, in bed, not having left at all. Her voice went on. I forgot about the day of the month when I told you Monday night. You surprised me, I guess, down on the street Saturday. I forgot what day it was, anyhow, till after you'd gone. His voice was as quiet as hers. How sick? Haven't you got some medicine at home that you can take? Haven't I got... Her voice died. She said, well, say. And suddenly, it's late, and you with 4 miles to walk. I've already walked it now. I'm here now. His voice was quiet, hopeless, calm. I reckon it's getting late, he said. Then something changed. Not looking at him, she sensed something before she heard it in his hard voice. What kind of sickness have you got? She didn't answer at once. Then she said, still down-looking, you haven't ever had a sweetheart yet. I bet you haven't. He didn't answer. Have you? He didn't answer. She moved. She touched him for the first time. She came and took his arm lightly in both hands. Looking down, he could see the dark shape of the lowered head, which appeared to have been set out of line a little on the neck when she was born. She told him, halting, clumsily, using the only words which she knew, perhaps. But he'd heard it before. He'd already fled backward past the slain sheep, the price paid for immunity, to the afternoon when, sitting on a creek bank, he'd been not hurt or astonished so much as outraged. The arm which she held jerked free. She didn't believe that he'd intended to strike her. She believed otherwise, in fact. But the result was the same. As he faded on down the road, the shape, the shadow, she believed that he was running. She could hear his feet for some time after she could no longer see him. She didn't move at once. She stood as he'd left her, motionless, down-looking, as though waiting for the blow which she'd already received. He wasn't running, but he was walking fast and in a direction that was taking him further yet from home, from the house 5 miles away which he'd left by climbing from a window and which he hadn't yet planned any way of re-entering. He went on down the road fast, and turned from it and sprang over a fence into plowed earth. Something was growing in the furrows. Beyond were woods, trees. He reached the woods and entered, among the hard trunks, the branch-shadowed quiet, hard-feeling, hard-smelling, invisible. In the not-seeing and the hard-knowing, as though in a cave, he seemed to see a diminishing row of suavely-shaped urns in moonlight, blanched. And not one was perfect. Each one was cracked, and from each crack there issued something liquid, death-colored and foul. He touched a tree, leaning his propped arms against it, seeing the ranked and moonlit urns. He vomited. On the next Monday night he had the rope. He was waiting at the same corner. He was quite early again. Then he saw her. She came up to where he stood. I thought maybe you wouldn't be here, she said. Did you? He took her arm, drawing her on down the road. Where are we going? She said. He didn't answer, drawing her on. She had to trot to keep up. She trotted clumsily, an animal impeded by that which distinguished her from animals, her heels, her clothes, her smallness. He drew her from the road toward the fence which he'd crossed a week ago. "Wait," she said, the words jolting from her mouth. "The fence. I can't." As she stooped to go through between the strands of wire which he'd stepped over, her dress caught. He leaned and jerked it free with a ripping sound. "I'll buy you another one," he said. She said nothing. She let herself be half-carried and half-dragged among the growing plants, the furrows, and into the woods, the trees.
This ends Disc 6.
He kept the rope, neatly coiled, behind the same loose board in his attic room where Mrs. McEachern kept her hoard of nickels and dimes, with the difference that the rope was thrust further back into the hole than Mrs. McEachern could reach. He'd got the idea from her. Sometimes, with the old couple snoring in the room beneath, when he lifted out the silent rope, he would think of the paradox. Sometimes he thought about telling her, of showing her where he kept the implement of his sin. Having got the idea, learned how and where to hide it from her. But he knew that she would merely want to help him conceal it, that she would want him to sin in order that she could help him hide it, that she would at last make such a to-do of meaningful whispers and signals that McEachern would have to suspect something despite himself. Thus he began to steal, to take money from the hoard. It's very possible that the woman didn't suggest it to him, never mentioned money to him. It's possible that he didn't even know that he was paying with money for pleasure. It was that he had watched for years Mrs. McEachern hide money in a certain place. Then he himself had something which it was necessary to hide. He put it in the safest place which he knew. Each time he hid or retrieved the rope, he saw the tin can containing money. The first time he took 50 cents. He debated for some time between 50 cents and a quarter. Then he took the 50 cents because that was the exact sum he needed. With it, he bought a stale and fly-specked box of candy from a man who'd won it for 10 cents on a punching board in a store. He gave it to the waitress. It was the first thing which he'd ever given her. He gave it to her as if no one had ever thought of giving her anything before. Her expression was a little strange when she took the tawdry, shabby box into her big hands. She was sitting at the time on her bed in her bedroom in the small house where she lived with a man and woman called Max and Mame. One night, about a week before, the man came into the room. She was undressing, sitting on the bed while she removed her stockings. He came in and leaned against the bureau, smoking. "A rich farmer," he said. "John Jacob Astor from the cowshed." She'd covered herself, sitting on the bed, still, down-looking. "He pays me." "With what? Hadn't he used up that nickel yet?" He looked at her. "A set-up for hayseeds. That's what I brought you down here from Memphis for. Maybe I'd better start giving away grub, too." "I'm not doing it on your time." "Sure. I can't stop you. I'd just hate to see you. Kid that never saw a full dollar at one time in his life, with this town full of guys making good jack that would treat you right." "Maybe I like him. Maybe you hadn't thought of that." He looked at her, at the stilled and lowered crown of her head as she sat on the bed, her hands on her lap. He leaned against the bureau, smoking. He said, "Mame." After a while, he said again, "Mame, come in here." The walls were thin. After a while, the big blonde woman came up the hall without haste. They could both hear her. She entered. "Get this," the man said. "She says maybe she likes him best. It's Romeo and Juliet, for sweet Jesus." The blonde woman looked at the dark crown of the waitress's head.
What about that?
Nothing. It's fine. Max Comfrey presenting Miss Bobby Allen, the youth's companion.
Go out, the woman said.
Sure. I just brought a change for a nickel.
He went out. The waitress hadn't moved.
The blonde woman went to the bureau and leaned against it, looking at the other's lowered head.
Does he ever pay you? She said.
The waitress didn't move.
Yes, he pays me.
The blonde woman looked at her, leaning against the bureau as Max had done.
Coming all the way down here from Memphis, bringing it all the way down here to give it away.
The waitress didn't move.
Not hurting Max.
The blonde woman looked at the other's lowered head, then she turned and went toward the door.
See that you don't, she said. This won't last forever. These little towns won't stand for this long.
I know. I came from one of them.
Sitting on the bed, holding the cheap, florid candy box in her hand, she sat as she'd sat while the blonde woman talked to her. But it was now Joe who leaned against the bureau and looked at her. She began to laugh. She laughed, holding the gaudy box in her big-knuckled hands. Joe watched her. He watched her rise and pass him, her face lowered. She passed through the door and called Max by name. Joe had never seen Max, save in the restaurant, in the hat and the dirty apron. When Max entered, he wasn't even smoking. He thrust out his hand.
"How are you, Romeo?" he said.
Joe was shaking hands almost before he'd recognized the man.
"My name's Joe McKeeker," he said.
The blonde woman had also entered. It was also the first time he'd ever seen her, save in the restaurant. He saw her enter, watching the waitress open the box. She extended it.
"Joe brought it to me," she said.
The blonde woman looked at the box once. She didn't even move her hand.
"Thanks," she said.
The man also looked at the box without moving his hand.
"Well, well, well," he said. "Sometimes Christmas lasts for a good while. Hey, Romeo?"
Joe had moved a little away from the bureau. He'd never been in the house before. He was looking at the man, with on his face an expression a little placative and baffled, though not alarmed, watching the man's inscrutable and monk-like face. But he said nothing. It was the waitress who said, "If you don't like it, you don't have to eat it." He watched Max, watching his face, hearing the waitress' voice, the voice down-looking.
"Not doing you and nobody else any harm. Not on his time."
He wasn't watching her, nor the blonde woman either. He was watching Max with that expression, puzzled, placative, not afraid. The blonde woman now spoke. It was as though they were speaking of him and in his presence and in a tongue which they knew that he didn't know.
"Come on out," the blonde woman said.
"Sweet Jesus," Max said. "I was just going to give Romeo a drink on the house."
"Does he want one?"
the blonde woman said. Even when she addressed Joe directly, it was as if she still spoke to Max.
"Do you want a drink?" "Don't hold him in suspense because of his past behavior. Tell him it's on the house."
"I don't know," Joe said. "I never tried it."
"Never tried anything on the house," Max said. "For sweet Jesus."
He hadn't looked at Joe once again after he entered the room. Again, it was as if they talked at and because of him in a language which he didn't understand.
"Come on," the blonde woman said. "Come on now."
They went out. The blonde woman had never looked at him at all, and the man, without looking at him, had never ceased. Then they were gone. Joe stood beside the bureau. In the middle of the floor, the waitress stood, down-looking, with the open box of candy in her hand. The room was close, smelling of stale scent. Joe had never seen it before. He hadn't believed that he ever would. The shades were drawn. The single bulb burned at the end of a cord, shaded by a magazine page pinned about it and already turned brown from the heat. "It's all right," he said. "It's all right." She didn't answer nor move. He thought of the darkness outside, the night in which they'd been alone before. "Let's go," he said. "Go?" she said. Then he looked at her. "Go where?" she said. "What for?" Still, he didn't understand her. He watched her come to the bureau and set the box of candy upon it. While he watched, she began to take her clothes off, ripping them off and flinging them down. He said, "Here? In here?" It was the first time he'd ever seen a naked woman, though he'd been her lover for a month. But even then, he didn't even know that he hadn't known what to expect to see. That night, they talked. They lay in the bed in the dark, talking. Or he talked, that is. All the time, he was thinking, "Jesus, Jesus, so this is it." He lay naked, too, beside her, touching her with his hand and talking about her. Not about where she'd come from and what she'd even done, but about her body, as if no one had ever done this before, with her or with anyone else. It was as if with speech he were learning about women's bodies with the curiosity of a child. She told him about the sickness of the first night. It didn't shock him now. Like the nakedness and the physical shape, it was like something which had never happened or existed before. So he told her in turn what he knew to tell. He told her about the Negro girl in the mill shed on that afternoon 3 years ago. He told her quietly and peacefully, lying beside her, touching her. Perhaps he couldn't even have said if she listened or not. Then he said, "You noticed my skin? My hair?" Waiting for her to answer, his hand slow on her body. She whispered also, "Yes, I thought maybe you were foreigner, that you never come from round here." "It's different from that, even. More than just a foreigner." "You can't guess?" "What? How more different?" "Guess." Their voices were quiet. It was still quiet. Night, now known, not to be desired, pined for. "I can't. What are you?" His hand was slow and quiet on her invisible flank. He didn't answer at once. It wasn't as if he were tantalizing her. It was as if he just hadn't thought to speak on. She asked him again. Then he told her. "I got some nigger blood in me." Then she lay perfectly still, with a different stillness, but he didn't seem to notice it. He lay peacefully, too, his hand slow up and down her flank. "You what?" she said. "I think I got some nigger blood in me." His eyes were closed, his hand slow and unceasing. "I don't know. I believe I have." She didn't move. She said at once, "You're lying." "All right," he said, not moving, his hand not ceasing. "I don't believe it," her voice said in the darkness. "All right," he said, his hand not ceasing. The next Saturday, he took another half dollar from Mrs. McGeekern's hiding place and gave it to the waitress. A day or two later, he had reason to believe that Mrs. McGeekern had missed the money and that she suspected him of having taken it, because she lay in wait for him until he knew that she knew that McGeekern wouldn't interrupt them. Then she said, "Joe?" He paused and looked at her, knowing that she wouldn't be looking at him. She said, not looking at him, her voice flat, level, "I know how a young man growing up needs money more than Mr. McGeekern gives you." He looked at her until her voice ceased and died away. Apparently he was waiting for it to cease. Then he said, "Money? What do I want with money?" On the next Saturday, he earned $2 chopping wood for a neighbor. He lied to McGeekern about where he was going and where he'd been and what he'd done there. He gave the money to the waitress. McGeekern found out about the work. Perhaps he believed that Joe had hidden the money. Mrs. McGeekern may have told him so. Perhaps two nights a week, Joe and the waitress went to her room. He didn't know at first that anyone else had ever done that. Perhaps he believed that some peculiar dispensation had been made in his favor, for his sake. Very likely, until the last, he still believed that Max and Mame had to be placated, not for the actual fact, but because of his presence there. But he didn't see them again in the house, although he knew that they were there. But he didn't know for certain if they knew that he was there or had ever returned after the night of the candy. Usually, they met outside, went somewhere else, or just loitered on the way to where she lived. Perhaps he believed up to the last that he had suggested it. Then one night, she didn't meet him where he waited. He waited until the clock in the courthouse struck 12. Then he went on to where she lived. He'd never done that before, though even then he couldn't have said that she'd ever forbidden him to come there unless she was with him. But he went there that night, expecting to find the house dark and asleep. And the house was dark, but it wasn't asleep. He knew that, that beyond the dark shades of her room people weren't asleep, and that she wasn't there alone. How he knew it, he couldn't have said. Neither would he admit what he knew. "It's just Max," he thought. "It's just Max." But he knew better. He knew that there was a man in the room with her. He didn't see her for 2 weeks, though he knew that she was waiting for him. Then one night he was at the corner when she appeared. He struck her without warning, feeling her flesh. He knew then what even yet he hadn't believed. "Oh," she cried. He struck her again. "Not here," she whispered. "Not here." Then he found that he was crying. He hadn't cried since he could remember. He cried, cursing her, striking her. Then she was holding him. Even the reason for striking her was gone then. "Now, now," she said, "now, now." They didn't leave the corner even that night. They didn't walk on loitering, nor leave the road. They sat on a sloping grass bank and talked. She talked this time, telling him. It didn't take much telling. He could see now what he discovered that he'd known all the time. The idle men in the restaurant with their cigarettes bobbing as they spoke to her in passing, and she going back and forth, constant, down-looking, and abject. Listening to her voice, he seemed to smell the odor reek of all anonymous men above dirt. Her head was a little lowered as she talked, the big hands still on her lap. He couldn't see, of course. He didn't have to see. "I thought you knew," she said. "No," he said. "I reckon I didn't." "I thought you did." "No," he said. "I don't reckon I did." 2 weeks later, he'd begun to smoke, squinting his face against the smoke, and he drank, too. He would drink at night with Max and Mame, and sometimes three or four other men, and usually another woman or two, sometimes from the town, but usually strangers who would come in from Memphis and stay a week or a month as waitresses behind the restaurant counter where the idle men gathered all day. He didn't always know their names, but he could cock his hat as they did. During the evenings, behind the drawn shades of the dining room at Max's, he cocked it so and spoke of the waitress to the others, even in her presence, in his loud, drunken, despairing young voice, calling her his whore. Now and then, in Max's car, he took her to dances in the country, always careful that McEachern shouldn't hear about it. "I don't know which he'd be madder at," he told her, "at you or at the dancing." Once they had to put him to bed, helpless, in the house where he had not even ever dreamed at one time that he could enter. The next morning the waitress drove him out home before daylight so he could get into the house before he was caught. And during the day, McEachern watched him with dour and grudging approval. "But you have still plenty of time to make me regret that heifer," McEachern said.